futuro.
Birth moved out of the communities, went into an institution, and who was practiced on and mistreated the most were these communities of color.
Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, what's up, fam? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I don't know. Today, I think I got to say WOC perspective. Because it's a woman of color show today. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Julio is taking the week off from recordings. So, yeah, it's me. And, you know, this past weekend, we marked Mother's Day. Today is May 10th. And I am still celebrating because in Mexico, today is 10 de Mayo, which is El Día de las Madres. In Mexico, you celebrate May 10th, no matter what day it falls. We're going to talk about motherhood, siendo mamás, healthcare, childbirth, and what it means for women of color and also the trans community. So from the Tewa territory of Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Marina Valenzuela Farrell. She's a Chicanx midwife and director of the Changing Woman Initiative. Hey, Marina.
Hola. Thank you so much.
Welcome, welcome. And joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Dr. Rachel Hardiman. She's a reproductive health equity researcher and a tenured associate professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Welcome, Rachel. And yes, for that tenure.
Thanks, Maria. Happy to be here.
You know, I have to be really honest with you. I'm not a big fan of like Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, Father's Day, you know. I'm just not a big fan of kind of Hallmark holidays, even though I understand, you know, that they're important to a certain degree. But interestingly, this year, like I found myself posting on my Instagram, on my Twitter. I was like, oh my God, here I am with my mom. Here I am with my kids. I mean, I was surprised. And I think it's kind of my reaction, like in the pandemic.
Yep.
You know, just kind of feeling like, oh my God, I just want to celebrate anything that I can. I think part of it is that, you know, I have a complex relationship to motherhood, to the concept of motherhood, to what's a good mother, what's a mother who's different, mothers who are gone, my best friend. I posted because I'm like, you're not here, but I'm a mother to your two kids. So it can be a lot for us. And as women of color, added on top of that. So before we dive into our conversation, I just want to do what we do here on the show, which is a temperature check. So, you know, kind of how you doing? So Marina, let's start with you. How you doing?
Oh, thank you. I'm missing my mom too. I know so many people out there have these complicated relationships with their mothers, or perhaps they're grieving mothers, or perhaps they don't know if they should be called mothers, or, you know, all of these things. And so it is definitely something that we think about a lot, because here at Changing Woman, you know, we have so many different types of parents, you know, and people with so many different backgrounds and relationships. And so I think, like, for me, I'm missing my mom. She passed a couple of years ago, and I celebrate her though. You know, I'm kind of grateful she passed before COVID. And yeah, but I'm doing good. I'm really excited to talk about this theme, you know, and to really have an honest conversation about this idea of motherhood.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Okay, Rachel, what's your temperature check? How you doing?
I am doing okay for a Monday. I had a wonderful weekend. I am a mother to an 8-year-old girl, Layla, who is my pride and joy. And I got to spend the weekend hanging out with her, as well as my nephew, who's 3.5. I have an identical twin sister. And so we each have one kiddo, and they are brother and sister, and we operate sort of as one family unit. And so I got to spend the weekend with them and my mom, my amazing mom, who lives just 5 minutes down the street from me. So I feel very lucky. And I recognize that that is not the case for a lot of people in my community and people that I love even. And it's been a hard year. You know, Maria, when you said you found yourself sort of celebrating Mother's Day differently this year, posting about it, I think all of that has to do with the year that mothers have been through. We've all been through, right? But I think certainly we have seen what COVID and the pandemic has done to motherhood in a very, very real way.
Which means, oh, wait a second, I need to go do a load of laundry before I record my next sentence. You mean that?
Exactly. Or I need to get my child logged into Zoom for their second grade class. Or I need to figure out how to make sure that they're mentally well, even though we have been, you know, apart and away from family and friends for so long.
Right. You know, I just got to give a shout out to my adult kids because they totally hooked it up. When I came home after spending a night away with my husband alone, which was a great Mother's Day gift, I came home and I had a book about Frederick Douglass, a book about plants, and a book about birds. And I'm like, oh my God, my kids, they totally know me. I love them so much. All right. So look, now we're going to get to some serious issues. And here's the reality. According to the CDC, about 700 women die each year in the United States from complications related to their pregnancy. And the thing is that, you know, this country says it is the most modern, advanced, industrialized. And so 700 women every year is too many. And Black and Indigenous people are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related issues than their white counterparts. You know, the relationship with the medical field and doctors, and whether or not we, as you know, people of color, can have a say over how we are treated, probably is one of the factors here. Earlier this month, Representative Cori Bush testified before the House Oversight Committee about her own experiences during childbirth. Let's take a listen.
Around 5 months, I went to see my doctor for a routine prenatal visit. As I was sitting in the doctor's office, I noticed a picture on the wall that said, "If you feel like something is wrong, tell your doctor." I felt like something was wrong, so that's what I did. I told my doctor, I told her that I was having severe pains, and she said, "Oh no, you're fine. You're fine, go home, and I'll see you next time." So that's what I did, I went home. 1 week later, I went into preterm labor. At 23 weeks, my son was born, 1 pound, 3 ounces. His ears were still in his head. His eyes were still fused shut. His fingers were smaller than rice, and his skin was translucent, a black baby, translucent skin. You could see his lungs. He could fit within the palm of my hand. We were told he had a 0% chance of life. The chief of neonatal surgery happened to be in the hospital that morning and saw my case on the surgical board, and she decided to try to resuscitate him. It worked, and for the first month of his life, Zion was on a ventilator fighting to live. For 4 months, he was in the neonatal care unit. The doctor who delivered my son apologized. She said, "You were right, and I didn't listen to you. Give me another chance." 2 months later, I was pregnant again, so I went back to her. At 16 weeks, I went for an ultrasound at the clinic and saw a different doctor who was working that day. I found out again I was in preterm labor. The doctor told me that the baby was going to abort. I said, "No, you have to do something." But he was adamant, and he said, "Just go home. Let it abort. You can get pregnant again because that's what you people do." My sister Kelly was with me. We didn't know what to do after the doctor left. So we saw a chair sitting in the hallway. My sister picked up the chair and she threw it down the hallway. Nurses came running from everywhere to see what was wrong. A nurse called my doctor and she put me on a stretcher. The next morning, my doctor came in and placed a cerclage on my uterus, and I was able to carry my baby, my daughter, my angel, who is now 20 years old, my son, who was saved, is now 21 years old. This is what desperation looks like, that chair flying down a hallway. This is what being your own advocate looks like.
So, Rachel, I bet you're just like, wow.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, that was a lot. Wow. But we're talking about basically structural racism, systemic racism, historical racism, patriarchy. I mean, how does all of that fit into gaps in care so something like this could happen?
Yeah. And the sad thing is, this is one of many, many stories. One of many. Every time I hear a new story, my heart is just, you know, in pieces. You know, just as you said, Maria, at the root of these issues is structural racism and racism in all of its forms and white supremacy that our healthcare system has been built within, right? And we haven't reckoned with that. We haven't talked about it. You know, we looked at births over almost 20 years in Florida to see if there was a difference when Black newborns were cared for by Black physicians. And we looked at 1.8 million births, and we found that when a Black newborn is born in a hospital or with a Black physician, they are less likely to die, which says a lot, not necessarily about that individual physician, right? We can talk about, you know, implicit bias and sort of all of the problems that we see, you know, in the ways that individual people are interacting with one another. But we also have to talk about the fact that these people are caring for people in a system that is structurally racist. And we have to be able to unpack all of that and figure out ways to dismantle it.
Yes, like 100% yes. By the way, I did a whole documentary for America by the Numbers about infant mortality in Rochester, New York, which has one of the highest rates, especially for Puerto Rican, mm-hmm. Native American, and Black women.
Yep.
And I'm just going to give you some stats. This is from 2017 from ProPublica and NPR. A Black woman is 243% more likely to die from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes than a white woman. And even in New York City, we had a recent death of a young woman, 26 years old, who died during a C-section, which I had too. So, you know, Marina, your organization, the Changing Woman Initiative, is doing something to push back on this, right? To keep cultural birth knowledge alive.
Right.
I mean, I'm so thankful for my mom. She just helped me so much throughout the entire process, right? Mm-hmm. And you, in specific, are supporting Indigenous women in reclaiming their sovereignty when it comes to reproductive health and wellness. Mm. So our intrepid producer, Harsha Nahata, spoke with Melissa Rose. She's a mother of five, soon to be a grandmother, who's living and working as a home birth midwife serving Indigenous families on the lands of the Tiwa and Tewa and Diné people in what's known as New Mexico. And she's the midwifery consultant for Indigenous Women Rising. And she co-founded the National Indigenous Midwifery Alliance. She's busy, is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Let's take a listen to what Melissa told Harsha about her experience with pregnancy.
I was a young parent. I was 15, and I was given access to some Indigenous midwives in the upstate New York area who really set me on a course that I don't know that I would have had access to otherwise if it wasn't for them. They were kind of the first people who ever told me that I was allowed to say no to someone who wanted to do something to my body, and that I had the right to make my own choices regarding my body. I had not heard that before from anyone, that conversation around consent and my own personal decision-making as a mother, as a Native woman. I feel like in our communities, that is something that's taken away pretty early or never really asserted because of how Native women are sexualized in the media and dehumanized in many ways. And I feel like our relationship to our bodies sometimes sort of mirrors how dominant society relates to the land as far as like ownership. And because we are so tied to the land, we do relate our bodies to how we care for the land.
Mm. So there is something about really understanding our own power. And Marina, you're basically trying to reclaim this for Indigenous women.
Yeah.
So how do you kind of reimagine caregiving, Indigenous women taking control when we are within this Western colonial healthcare system?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I love, you know, just to give a little bit of honor to Melissa's story, that's really powerful. Her words are really important because I feel like so many Native and Indigenous families feel that way. You know, one of the things I talk about when we talk about systemic racism is that I don't think that people really understand when it comes to birth that it was the traditional communities that we had our birth keepers. You know, we had our medicine people, our birth keepers. Same with the African American community. You know, we had our traditional ways of doing birth that was really based on the community where you grew up and where you were from. And if you look at the Native American experience in the United States, you know, the communities were decimated. People were taken out of their communities. They still to this day often have to travel quite far to birth and have really lost their traditional healers. And, you know, the same with the Latinx community. So many of us in the Latinx community are Indigenous as well. And there's also something about, like, we don't really know the data, Maria. Like, there is an issue with data around Native people. It's often incorrect. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of racial miscategorization that happens. Mm. So we don't really actually know how bad it is. We know it's bad. What's really interesting is that Indigenous folks also report the most mistreatment in birth. People are getting treated terribly. And there's also sort of this like unconsciousness around the systems that support Indigenous folks, whether they're, you know, immigrants or whether they're local Native people to the United States. I always talk about one of the blessings of COVID was that it opened up people's eyes to the fact that like families do get separated at birth. They do have to birth alone. And that's been happening to Indigenous populations for forever. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when white middle-class women or upper-class women started to have to birth on their own during COVID, they were like, wait, this is outrageous, you know? And so I always like to bring that into as this example of like, well, there has been this historic mistreatment, particularly when it comes to obstetrics or reproductive care, when the traditional midwife was taken out of Native, Indigenous, and Black communities, became these male obstetricians, mm-hmm. birth moved out of the communities, went into mm-hmm. an institution, mm-hmm. and who was practiced on and who was mistreated the most
right.
were these communities of color. And so it's been forever.
Mm-hmm. You're not going to believe who actually sent me a little Mother's Day text. It was my doula,
oh.
who I haven't heard from, and, you know, because my kids are 25 and 23, but I'm like,
wow.
were it not for my doula.
That's right.
And I had community.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right. We're going to talk now more structurally, right, which is what you were alluding to.
Sure.
Because, you know, you can't kind of look at what's happening in terms of the attacks on reproductive health separately from this country's historical roots in white supremacy and colonialism.
Yeah.
So for hundreds of years, Indigenous midwifery was targeted, in fact, by colonial governments and medical institutions. Again, as you were saying, Indigenous women were, in fact, forced to give birth in hospitals.
And still are.
And still are, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to Melissa Rose, who said this about the Indian Health Service, which is the federal agency responsible for providing medical care for Indigenous people.
Can we access health care in a reproductive justice framework, in an ecologically sound and just framework through IHS, through a colonial system? I don't think so. But that's okay because we've always had these ways of caring for ourselves. All of our work that we do at Indigenous Women Rising is really rooted, first of all, in love for our community. We are not, you know, these powerful institutions. We are community members and we are taking care of our family like our life ways, you know, demand that we do, like our responsibilities towards each other demand that we care for each other in this way. I'm not sure that you can humanize an institution to have love for community. And I don't think that you get a reclamation of body sovereignty from an institution. It's not a gift that they can bestow on us. It's something we have to reclaim for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we know that following the Family Planning Services and Population Research Act of 1970, physicians sterilized at least 1/4 of Indigenous women of childbearing age, though the numbers are probably higher. And so this notion of actually sterilizing women, it's not in the past only,
right?
Because there's the recent story of what happened in Irwin County Immigration and Customs Enforcement Detention Center mm-hmm. in Georgia, where more than 40 women have submitted claims of an unwanted medical procedure, including forced hysterectomies, okay?
In 2020.
Exacto. Indigenous women, 1970s.
Yeah.
Puerto Rican women, one of the most political films as a young feminist for me was La Operación,
mm-hmm.
to see what they were doing to Puerto Rican women. And now, you know, just in the past few years, to women whose only difference is that we were not born in this country and therefore they took our uteruses. So, Rachel, can you talk a little bit more about how this push to control access to reproductive health, we have to have a language where we can put it into context in terms of white supremacy,
absolutely.
Patriarchy, and give us the tools to then say, well, no, Mr. and Mrs. Doctor, you're not going to actually be able to do this to my body or put something in my body or take my baby away. No. How do we do this? We'll start with you, Rachel.
Yeah, there's so many things to unpack there. And I think one of the things that Melissa Rose said is incredibly important. And that's the question of, can we expect these institutions to humanize us? Or do we need to reclaim that for ourselves? And I think that's exactly the question that we need to be holding and thinking about, right? Is that we're at a point, in my opinion, where we need to be redesigning systems that are made for us and will care for us. I mean, what we see even in some of the research I've done is that when a woman of color in particular decides to speak up and say no to a procedure or have a question about it, the likelihood of them reporting discrimination and racism after that encounter is significantly higher, right? So even when you sort of take it upon yourself to have autonomy and to ask questions and even, you know, decline something, a procedure during the childbirth period, there can be backlash there. So we have to be thinking from this reproductive justice framework of how do we create systems that honor and reclaim lost culture, that center that culture in how we deliver care. And I think that that can be done in a lot of different ways. So, you know, we know that the midwifery model is incredibly important. We know that freestanding birth centers, community-based birth centers have the power to do that work. Some of the work we've done here in the Twin Cities in Minnesota has shown that in Roots Community Birth Center, a freestanding Black-owned, Black-led birth center, the way that culture is centered and the way that the staff there are able to meet families where they're at and with whatever it is that they need is incredibly powerful. But we also know that not everyone has access right now to that type of care. And so we need to also be working to change that, right? So thinking about how to ensure that folks who want access have access to the midwifery model of care, but also understanding that there's just going to be some folks who aren't able to receive midwifery care for a variety of reasons. So then the question is, how do we ensure that those folks are entering into spaces in our medicalized system, in our healthcare system, that will ensure their safety and ensure their needs are honored?
I am just so thankful that at least the second time around, my first was a scheduled cesarean. My second, I had a doula with me. And I remember they came and they put a little thing on me and they were like, no, you're not having any contractions. And I was like, well, the machine says I'm not having, but I'm telling you, I am having a contraction right now. And just, well, who do you think you are to answer back to a nurse? And I'm just like, yeah. Marina, when you think about, like, you know, racism and patriarchy and what you're trying to do to kind of break this historical grip, this is not standalone issues. This is part of the history of this country.
Oh, yes, it definitely is. And, you know, just thinking about when Melissa was talking about the IHS, you know, the IHS in Phoenix, Arizona closed their OB unit right at the height of COVID. I think a lot of folks that aren't Native don't understand that IHS is actually very particular. They don't just cover everybody right off the bat. You have to actually be in your area of service. And so it left all of these families scrambling right at the height of COVID to find care. And that's just like an example of why would you, if you were serving Native families that already have issues with access to maternal health and reproductive health, like why would you close your OB unit?
Right.
There are nonprofits there that are actually raising money to pay for these births. And, you know, the average OB visit, it's like 4 minutes.
Right.
And I do think that there is a language of violence and there is also a language of like not listening that happens.
Absolutely.
When you were talking about not being believed, that happens all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Like, listen, own your voice.
Yes.
Doctors and nurses, they are not gods.
No.
Right.
I learned how to say no to doctors from my husband. Mm. I remember when they took my daughter away because they were like, she's jaundiced. My husband stood up and said, give the baby back to my wife or else.
Right.
And, you know, he's an Afro-Dominican man with an accent. And I mean, the next thing that could have happened is they would have said, we're going to call security. And he was like, it didn't happen because my husband said, this is my pediatrician's phone number. You call him now. That baby is ours.
Yes.
But it's like, why do we have to kind of have a fight in the hospital, you know?
Right.
Yeah. It's so layered that like, you don't do what they say. If you're a person of color, then they're going to like call, you know, just, you're just going to have a courtesy visit from social services, you know, or something like that. And midwives also are traditional care providers. And I think that, you know, access to maternal health is already complicated in this country for everybody, because when you look at how many counties in this country do not have an obstetric provider of any sort, it's almost 50%, Maria. It's really high. Mm-hmm. And so then you throw in like the challenges of rural living or the challenges of language barriers or whatever. And then you have so much less access. And, you know, for our communities here in New Mexico and in Arizona as well, you know, COVID really made that obvious, because as it is in New Mexico, Native families weren't seeing care providers often for prenatal care or postpartum care. Mm-hmm. So then once COVID hit, our families were lucky if they were having one postpartum visit. And so it's really critical that we look at that. But then also you think about, it's like, you know, one in two Native women are also subject to domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's so many other layers here, right? That when you don't have a supportive environment for a person who's having a baby, and you sort of act like their body and their baby belongs to the system and not to them, not to their own autonomous self, then what ends up happening is then you strip the humanity away from that. And you take away the ceremony, you take away the love, the joy of having a baby. And right. all that's left is like this trauma.
Right.
What family wants to go back into an environment where there's trauma?
Exactly.
Right. And then just, I mean, I went through two miscarriages. It's quite lonely. There's a lot that, and because we have, you know, this notion of patriarchy, well, it's, you know, something just like get over it. I can talk about this stuff because I just feel like there is not enough space where women can be more honest about this. So I just really appreciate the both of you and the work that you're doing with, you know, giving women the power to stand up for themselves and believe in their bodies. Now, Rachel, you are taking it kind of to a next level. You launched a 5-year study recently to investigate the links between racialized police violence and preterm and low birth weight for Black infants. I mean, essentially, the relationship between police brutality, reproductive justice, toxic stress, how this affects you when you are carrying a baby inside of you. Ugh. So, Rachel, you are based in Minneapolis. You know, we're nearing the 1-year mark of the murder of George Floyd. We saw the conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin. And just last week, a federal grand jury indicted all 4 former officers for willfully depriving George Floyd of his constitutional rights. So what does your research say about police killings and how this affects health for mothers, for Black mothers, for women of color?
Yeah, thanks, Maria. So to start, I think it's important to understand when we talk about reproductive justice, it's not just about the right to maintain personal bodily autonomy and the right to have children or not have children, but it's also about the right to parent the children we have in safe and sustainable communities. And to me, a safe and sustainable community means one that's free from police brutality and police violence. And what we also know is that people, women are bringing their entire life and the context in which they live, work, and play into pregnancy and into the healthcare system every time they are pregnant or, you know, seeking care. And we have to understand that part of that means grappling with police violence. So I started looking into this question of this link between police killings of Black men or Black people and birth outcomes and maternal health outcomes about 5 years ago, actually in 2016, because Philando Castile had been shot and killed by a police officer in my community here in Minnesota. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and what we were hearing, we were doing another project where we were doing interviews with Black birthing women and their families for a completely different project. But what we were hearing from them is that they didn't want to find out the sex of the baby they were carrying when they hit that 20-week mark where you typically are excited for the anatomy scan and to find out if you're having a boy or a girl. Mm-hmm. And when we stopped to ask why, the reason was that the pain of knowing that they were having a boy was just too much to bear in those final weeks of pregnancy and the aftermath of Philando Castile. Mm. And, you know, here we are 5 years later, grappling with the murder of George Floyd and the trial that's ensued and the trauma that has repeatedly impacted certainly this community, my community and my people, but, mm-hmm. you know, nationally, right? And so, you know, what we're going to be able to look at with this study is to understand the patterns across the country of how racialized police violence and police brutality are impacting birth outcomes. So preterm birth and low birth weight for Black birthing people.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. We're going to move on to our final segment, which is La Última y Nos Vamos, as if I was a drinker that hung out in bars that you would say, okay, last one before you go.
I love it.
So this weekend, there was a Twitter storm. I'm so glad that I was off this weekend being celebrated and feted. But after Representative Cori Bush used the term birthing people in a tweet to be more gender inclusive, then conservatives and several white women lashed out in another example of white cis women basically co-opting the conversation around healthcare for women of color and trans people. Look, like we said at the top of the show, healthcare for childbirth impacts not just women, but trans and non-binary people too, who need equitable care because they're people. So on a recent episode of the Translash podcast, ITT All-Star Imara Jones spoke with Lasaya Wade, who's founder and executive director of the Brave Space Alliance. This is the first Black and trans-led LGBTQ center.
Yeah.
Is that cool? On the south side of Chicago. Hello, where I grew up, go south side of Chicago. This is Lasaya talking about her and her partner's journey of conceiving as a Black trans couple. Let's take a listen.
I'm wondering if you have thought about or what resources you think need to be created for Black trans people and Black trans couples who are creating families and wanting to create families.
So with that is it's very rare. And what I mean by it is it's a lot of us out there trying to have kids or trying to conceive or even mm-hmm. in partnership with other trans people. So we really had to figure out what queer spaces that we actually are feeling comfortable going into without the oohs and the ahs of like Black trans people are in this space, they're pregnant. And then, oh, we have to talk about what it looked like to be anti-Black. Well, we're just trying to really have a baby right now and focus our energy on that and making sure that he is okay through this moment. Less stress, please, less talk. But how do we make sure we move through this moment of having a baby right now? And explicitly navigating a system where Black pregnant bodies are constantly under worry around, will I make it out on the other end throughout this medical system? So lucky enough that we had his sister. His sister is a midwife and also a nurse. And that was a pinnacle point for us. And also one of our good friends was a midwife as well. So we really had the support that we needed to navigate the medical system if we had to go to the hospital or if we had to go to see a nurse in particular moments.
So help us for La Última yeah. to understand how we ground our ideas of parenthood and motherhood in inclusivity for trans and non-binary people. Mm. So let's start with you, Rachel, and we'll end with you, Marina.
So, I mean, I missed the Twitter storm too, which I'm actually grateful for because I took a break from social media for the weekend. But I think I work very hard to use the term birthing people and really framing the work that I do and the fact that not everyone who gives birth identifies as a woman. And I think that that's incredibly important to understand. And, you know, certainly just as, you know, Marina talked about sort of the erasure or lack of data around the Indigenous communities and birth outcomes there, we have the same issue when it comes to the transgender community and particularly Black trans people who are giving birth. And I think we have a lot of work to do in the reproductive justice space and the reproductive health space to really think about and center those folks in this discussion just as much as other folks we've, you know, centered in the discussion. And so I see the pathway for it, right? And I think that we all win when we all win, right? And so, you know, approaching it with an inclusive mindset is incredibly important.
And Marina?
Well, I think what I want to say is that every body needs the same thing. I think that people that are having a baby, they need to be surrounded by caregivers that are very accessible to them, that maybe look like them, that are maybe from their community, mm-hmm. that are surrounding them with love and with supportive folks like your doula, also giving them lots of information and knowledge. And people need to birth where they feel safe, whether that's
absolutely
at home or in a hospital or in a birth center. And there needs to be a recognition that the world of obstetrics in this country is very white. So there needs to be more providers, whether they're midwives or nurses or OBs, whatever it is, that look like the people who most need to access them. And so I think that there has to be also access to education, you know, for folks that want to serve their communities. And I think that ultimately, like our dream, right, is that every baby is going to be born surrounded by love.
Yeah.
And that the family that's birthing that baby is not going to be afraid. They're going to feel safe. They're going to feel listened to. They're going to feel supported no matter who they are, what they look like, you know, any of that stuff. I think we all need the same things.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate your thoughts. Marina Valenzuela Ferrell, who's director of the Changing Woman Initiative, and Dr. Rachel Hardiman, tenured associate professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Thank you so much for both of you for joining me on this episode of In the Thick and for this really important conversation among us. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
Thank you, Maria.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Uno, dos, tres.
And hey, ITT fam, before you go, yeah, we have a save the date for you. We have our first virtual live ITT of 2021. It's coming up Wednesday, May 26th at 7 p.m. Okay, what are you doing? You know, you're going to be at home. Julio and I will be joined by local Minneapolis journalists to discuss police violence, racial justice, and healing during the week that marks 1 year since the police murder of George Floyd. So for more information and to RSVP, go to bit.ly/ITT Minneapolis. And we're going to put this into our show notes so that if you didn't get it, you can find it there. And remember, dear listener, to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. It really helps other listeners to find us. Remember that you can listen to us on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you choose to get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at InTheThickShow. Like us on Facebook and tell everyone you know to listen. In the Thick is produced by Noor Saudi, Harsha Nahata, our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Lisa Salinas, and our intern, Nicole Basolino, with editorial support from Charlotte Mangin and Nicole Rothwell. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and CZK Records. Thank you for listening, my dear. See you on our next episode. Bye. I just put chocolate in my mouth. Oh my God, it was so perfect. You know, a mother's got to do what a mother's got to do, is all I'm saying. Are you both there? Marina, Rachel?
Hi, I'm here.
Yes, I'm here.
Please laugh when I tell a joke, okay? Don't leave me hanging out here.
You just had me thinking about chocolate.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.